I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Nigel Slater, on page one of his new memoir, makes the link between love and someone who makes toast for you. As your teeth break through the rough, toasted crust and sink into the doughy cushion of white bread underneath, he writes, once the warm, salty butter has hit your tongue, you are smitten putty in their hands. And he draws us closer to an appreciation of home when he later describes hotel toast as cold and bendy in a bent silver rack, and the butter hard and cold, too. But there's a lot more to this story than the memories conjured up by that first whiff of a roasting turkey and the tinny distant roar of a football game on TV. Nigel's story takes us also into the darker parts of memory, where the food's often cold and everything but comforting. We'd like to have you pull up a chair with us on this hour. We want to explore the way that food is so closely linked with our most powerful recollections and help us figure out why. I mean, it has to be more than that classic retreat to the fridge when friends and family let us down. It has to be more than just remembering the smell of something baking and what was going on at the time. Why is it that food is so evocative? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nigel Slater has been writing a food column for The Observer in London for more than a decade. He's also the author of a number of cookbooks. This book is about his own life. It's called Toast. He's here with me in the studio. Hi, Nigel.
Hi.
You describe entering into this project in an almost flip way, an editor saying, well, why don't you write a little bit about the, you know, the food that you knew as a child and the memories that that it brings back. And if I get your introduction, you're saying that you thought initially it was going to be a very easy assignment.
Yes, because what I imagined it to be was a sort of catalogue of the food, the home cooking of the 1960s and the 70s, and just how I remembered them. But as I started to write, and as I remembered these things, everything was linked to what was happening at the time. An emotional memory, also events, people that I'd actually forgotten about. This all came out with every single thing I wrote about.
How did you start? Did you start with a piece of paper and a list of food that you could sort of dredge up?
I started out with a list. I thought it was the easiest way. And I went through all my favourite things. And then there were a couple of things that I didn't like. And I thought, I want to write about these.
But milk would be one of those.
Milk. To this day, I cannot drink a glass of milk.
There's a great description in the book about being forced to drink milk in front of a bunch of classmates, which I'll leave to people's imagination. Suffice it to say, more comes up than goes down. But, okay, so you've got things you don't like, but I can't help but think that you do what I do, and that is sort of say, oh, I love this, and I love that, and this was warm, and this was friendly. Do you know what I mean? Food as comfort, that we'd all be inclined to start there. Were you as well looking for things that brought back warm memories, or were you just sort of saying, let's just see where this leads us?
It was very much a case of where this leads us. What I was trying to do was, in a way, to remember things, to remind people of things that we'd actually forgotten, that although they might still be available, because our cooking and our eating has moved on a bit and it's developed, we've actually forgotten some of these things we used to eat. Like, for instance, a pie which is made in a tin, and you actually put the whole tin in the oven and you pull it out, undo the top, and you've got this pie inside. Nobody ever buys it nowadays. But I wanted to remind people of those things. And the more I wrote, the more I thought about them, just everything flooded back about what was happening in my life at that time.
I'm wondering if there was a meal or a memory or something that caught you in going through this list where you thought to yourself, this exercise is going to take me to places that I hadn't actually really thought I would go to.
In truth, it was actually single dishes of things. It was something that my father gave to me that I suddenly remembered this was about bad times. I didn't intend to write about the bad times. I started it as being a very jolly, very happy piece. But it couldn't work like that because not everything was like that as a child. I actually had quite a tough time. And those tough times are still so connected with some of those things.
There's one story here which you're sort of leading us to, and I'm wondering if I can ask you to read that little part of the book. This is the story about the raspberries, the tinned raspberries that come in a bowl because if there's ever an example of a not particularly happy moment, this would certainly be it. We're jumping a little bit ahead in the book here because this comes... well, you know what? I'm just going to let you read it because it's kind of self-explanatory.
Canned raspberries. A few weeks after my mother died, we had canned raspberries for tea. Can I take mine in the other room, Daddy? Well, if you're very careful, there's lots of juice. I hold the dish with both hands and wonder why he has put so much juice in. But it is glorious juice, as garnet red as the stained glass windows behind the altar at St. Stephen's. The heady smell wafts up like wine. I put the fruit carefully down on the little red and white footstool my dad calls the poof, and drag it across the pale, dove-grey carpet. Raspberries are the most gorgeous of tin fruits we have, better than peaches, apricots, figs or strawberries, and there's so much juice. I'm dragging the stool across the carpet and keeping a close eye on the juice level, which is lapping at the edges of the dish. One of the front legs hits the rug in front of the fireplace, and from now on, everything is happening in slow motion. The stool judders, and the dish bounces slowly off onto the carpet. It's upside down. I calmly walk into the kitchen and pick up the white dishcloth from behind the taps. "You haven't," yells my father. And again, "You haven't." "I have." The juice is sinking into the carpet faster than I can mop it up. The stain, suddenly more like blood than juice, is getting wider, a full 2 feet across now. He storms in. His eyes are on fire. "Give it here." He grabs the dishcloth and the dish out of my hand and slops the soggy fruit back from where it came. He dabs pointlessly at the juice on the carpet. My father puts the dish down on the floor in the middle of the stain. He yanks me back with the blue collar of my T-shirt. "I told you to be careful." A slap flashes across my ear with every word. "I told you to be careful." Harder now. He just keeps slapping and slapping. My ear, the side of my head, my neck. One catches my earlobe. I'm in the corner by the door now, my back against the yellow wallpaper. I slide down to the floor. I put my hands up and over my head. He just keeps slapping. It's like he cannot stop. My ear is numb. My cheeks and head are stinging. My mouth is dry. Tears won't come. I want to go to the toilet. Everything has stopped. The room is silent. He's gone. I stand up and pull my left sock up, which has ruckled down to my ankle. I walk through the hall and then through the kitchen. Past the garage, I can see him in his greenhouse. He's got a pale pink begonia on the wooden slats and is pressing the soil tenderly down around the stem. He puts it back and picks up another, this time red. My father touches a bud with his thumb and forefinger and then a flower, pulling the petals back softly, like he's calming a sparrow with a broken wing. His face is scarlet, puffed. There are tears running down it.
That's Nigel Slater reading from his new memoir called Toast, The Story of One Boy's Hunger. I hadn't actually intended to start with that reading. It's sort of taken a little bit of the my breath away. I find it quite frightening, and I'm curious to know, as I was listening to you read the story, you talk about where the dishcloth was. It was behind the taps, that your T-shirt was blue, that when you got up you had your left sock down and need... How well that memory somehow carved into your mind, Nigel?
It is very strange that I can remember the smell, the taste, the colour of things from 40 years ago, and yet ask me what my cell phone number is and I don't know. I can remember every detail, and I think, in a way, with this particular chapter, it is partly because it was a very rare piece of violence, which didn't figure a lot in my childhood, and I was right. So shocked about it. But it was the food that unlocked it. When I decided to write the book, I went out and found all of the foods that I talked about, pretty much everything. Mm. as I open the can of raspberries and I look down this deep red juice to these little blobs of canned raspberries at the bottom.
Not really brilliant.
No. And strangely, fresh raspberries were there, but we thought tinned ones were a luxury.
Yeah.
It all just came back.
You begin the piece by saying, a few weeks after my mother died, and I know what our listeners won't at this point, that your mum died when you were just 9 years old. So you're really very young when this memory happens, when you go back to this. Did you find that in using the smells and the tastes of different childhood foods to go back, that you actually had easier access to the memories from when you were really quite young than perhaps when you were in your teens or getting older?
Do you know, a lot of the really early memories are much clearer and crisper than things that happened later. And I wonder, in a way, because when I was older, I went through a patch of actually not eating very interesting food. Probably from 18 onwards, there was a big patch of my life when food was actually quite dull and boring. And it's this early food, even if it wasn't always successful, my mother trying to cook, somehow those things trigger the memory.
I wonder if we've time for a short reading about rice pudding here. This is just, this takes us back to an earlier moment, and it's a description of yours when, here I go, chattering on about what it is, and it's better, I think, that we hear you read it. Can I get you to do that?
Rice pudding. Mother was desperate to be a homemaker, a woman capable of sewing on a button, darning a sock, or icing a cake. In the early evening, sitting under the standard lamp in the lounge, head tilted and the tip of her tongue pinched between her lips, she spent what seemed like hours trying to thread white cotton through the eye of a needle. "Let me do it," was met with a sigh, and "I've nearly done it now." Try as she might, buttons popped off within a day or two, toes poked through neat but ineffective repairs, and icing pooled into the craters on her cakes, or, on the rare occasion they rose, ran down the sides in rivulets and stuck the flowery cases to the plate. It was Mrs. Poole who made the beds, fed the wincette sheets through the ironing machine with its long cotton-covered roller, and would sew a stray button onto my school shirt. Mother made up for this humiliation by making rice pudding, warm, milky rice, rice that never thickened the sweet liquid it floated in, so that what should have been a creamy spoonful, the texture of risotto, had to be sipped like broth. The skin browned and puffed into a blackened gilt dome, and the kitchen smelled like a kitchen should. The skin was removed in one perfect scoop and deposited in my father's bowl. "It's the best bit," he used to say. Then the round rice was fished up from the depths and divided between us all. Then she would pick up the enamel tin and spoon out the milk. "Anyone for jam?" she would say, passing around the heartless strawberry. I was the only taker, stirring the sweet glop into the milk and then regretting it when it stayed in blobs and sank to the bottom of the dish. Milky, milky rice is considered a failure by rice pudding aficionados, yet I preferred it to her occasional successes. Warm, sweet milk was what a mother should smell of.
Nigel Slater is my guest this hour. He's just been reading from his new memoir called Toast, The Story of One Boy's Hunger. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour, and not just about why one piece of food might unlock one memory, but why it is food's so powerful. Give us a call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Nigel Slater is here with me in the studio. He's author of a new memoir called Toast, The Story of One Boy's Hunger. He's also the author of a number of cookbooks, Real Fast Food, Appetite among them. He writes a food column for The Observer in London, has done that for about 10 years. And so the memoir is a little bit of a departure for you, something new.
Yes, the first time I've ever written without recipes, without having to measure ingredients and remember what I'd done. It was quite refreshing, actually.
I bet you got a good reaction to it as well.
Yes, I mean, I was very nervous, I have to say, about partly doing a book that was what I call sort of joined-up writing, but also doing a book that was so intimate, because I'm not known for talking very much about my private life. I've never taken the sort of celebrity route of the cookery world. And so the intimacy, I was a little bit concerned how people would take it. But they seem okay with it.
Let's talk a bit about your mother. 9 years old you were when she died. She suffered from asthma. But as you describe her later years, you don't describe, and maybe this is entirely accurate, this is where I need you to help me, you don't describe the great fear of what's happening to my mom.
Well, that's right, and there's a very good reason for that. I was a very protected child. I mean, Mum had always looked after me. If there was the tiniest chance of rain, she'd get the car out to pick me up from school, and I had been quite mollycoddled in that way. And my parents would really never let me know what was going on. Things were always kept away from me. It was just a protection thing, I think. And I knew Mum was ill, partly because other kids' mums didn't have to grab an inhaler every hour. Other kids' mums wouldn't sit down and take big, deep breaths when they were working. And I was aware there was something not right. But it was only towards the end, when her inhalers for her asthma were in almost every cupboard and drawer, they were in the glove box of the car, they were there. I knew there was something wrong, but they protected me from knowing how ill she was.
Some great descriptions in the book about following along on an outside walk with your parents and just occasionally catching a word of or a hint that maybe they were being more serious than adults normally are.
Well, that's right. I mean, that thing of lagging behind and knowing that I shouldn't be involved in that conversation, this was something private, but picking up the odd little word and, in fact, very often getting things wrong. So there was a discussion I heard and I picked up the idea that Mum was going to have a baby, and I was really excited, and I couldn't understand why they were telling me, because she was talking about hospital and things like this. Yeah. And in fact, they had been discussing the fact that my mother was very, very ill indeed, and at some point, you know, they may have to face what would happen.
On the evening that she dies, you describe waking up in the bed and your father's there to comfort you, and you also tell a story then about some marshmallows left on the side of the bed. What's the link there?
When Mum died, I'd had an argument with her before she died. We were cooking together and she'd forgotten some of the ingredients. And my last words to my mother were very upsetting. And I stormed off into my bedroom in a huff. And I woke up the next day to find that my father was at the bottom of my bed crying. I thought it was Santa Claus. I thought this great big weight was a big sack full of toys. And it was him, sobbing. He simply said, "Mum's gone to heaven." And I was whisked off. I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral. I was sent off to an aunt and uncle. And when I came back, I went up to bed. And on my bedside table were two little marshmallows. Now, I'd never been allowed to eat. It was forbidden to eat before I went to bed, after I'd brushed my teeth. And I remember saying to my dad, "What, you know, are these for me?" He said, "Well, of course they are. They're your favourite things." And in fact, what he was referring to was just before Mum died, I'd written an essay at school, and I described marshmallows as being the nearest thing to a kiss, soft and pink and warm and tender. And he put them there, and he did every night for a long time. And yes, they were wonderful. I mean, they didn't replace Mum's cuddles and night-night sleep tight. But it was his way. It was the only way he knew how to do that.
What's so interesting about it in the story, and I think perhaps people who've been listening to us this hour will you know, benefit by knowing, is that, you know, while you've got the father who gets very angry with you when you spill the raspberries, he's a bit of a puzzle, because he has the capacity to know that leaving marshmallows for his young son is a nice thing to do. He's very, very tender with the flowers in the greenhouse. They are almost, I get the impression when I read you describing him in the greenhouse caring for the flowers, that you almost wish he cared for you with the same tenderness that he'd look after the blossoms.
I think I was probably jealous of the way he cared for his flowers and his blossoms. I mean, Dad never showed any real affection or tenderness. I mean, when he did, it made me feel so wonderful, when he let me climb upon his lap. When he did things that other kids' dads just did, you know, they put their arms around their children, mm-hmm. and things, and he never did any of that. And I think in a way, partly he was trying to balance the fact that Mum was completely the opposite and was very loving and very affectionate and showed it. And somehow, I think he realised I was becoming quite a gentle little boy, not the kid he really wanted. And he could see this happening. And this was his way of toughening me up. But when he did need to be affectionate, you know, every now and again, he got it right.
He did bring a lot of sweets into your life.
Yes,
chocolate bars.
For which my dentist is extraordinarily grateful.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Nigel Slater is my guest. We're talking about his new memoir, Toast. And going to Boston, Peg's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I'm really enjoying this conversation, and this book sounds extremely moving. I can't wait to read it. I was, in fact, just reading something by MFK Fisher yesterday. She wrote the text for a 1970s Time Life book on provincial French cooking. Beautifully written. I think that your stories about how re-experiencing these foods many, many years after the stories that you're writing about is very interesting, and I wondered if you had any familiarity with some of the writing that's been done on the connection between scent and memory. I think Diane Ackerman's written about this, the idea that the olfactory glands and the regions for memory in the brain are actually more closely linked than they are for, say, memory and vision or memory and hearing. And maybe that's partly why these memories come flooding back in the way that they do.
You know, the strange thing was that when I went to buy all of the foods of my childhood, it wasn't so much the taste that reminded me of things. It was opening a wrapper on a candy bar and just sniffing. It was taking the top off a can and breathing in the smell. It was almost before I'd put it in my mouth that these things just came back to me. And even after I'd eaten it, there were almost no more memories than there were that instant when I took a big, deep breath of the food. And I hadn't realised until then that this was going to happen. And I know recently there's been quite a lot has been written about how smell will do this. But this was my first experience of it.
I wonder if it's also a little bit of a part of the anticipation. I mean, you'll go out, you'll save some pocket money, you'll go out, you'll buy something that you want to eat at the sweet shop, and it'll be that moment of actually cracking the wrapper when your taste buds are sort of in overdrive.
Absolutely, yes.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Nigel Slater is my guest. We're talking about his new memoir, Toast. And where are we going next? Also to Boston, Mick's on the line. Hi, Mick. Mick, go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. I wanted to compliment you on the description of rice pudding. For me, it was round tree strawberry jam, but that congealing in the bottom of the bowl, it was so terrible. You prompted me to ring because I wanted to ask you a question. If you had any insight into why so often foods that we despise as a child in later life become foods that we just adore. For me, it's Wall's individual pork pies. I could never stomach them as a child. But as an immigrant now, it's the food stuff from home that I crave most. Why is that?
Well, I wish that I could totally agree with you. I've still got some problems with food that I didn't like, and I was force-fed. You see, there are things that I tried when I was young, like olives, and I hated olives. And now, a day isn't complete without a few olives. It's strange that I've grown into that. Partly, I think that's because salty wasn't really my thing when I was young. I was a sugar baby. I mean, I loved anything to do with sugar. But the foods that, you know, I was forced to eat because my father wanted me to be a big, strong boy. So he would make me drink milk and eat eggs. To this day, I still can't eat them. I mean, pork pies, I'm with you on pork pie, because when I was little, I used to eat the meat out of the middle, and I used to eat the crust. But that layer of jelly in the middle, I would spend hours scraping it out, like putting it on the side of my plate and not getting near it. Now I swear it's the best bit. I'd rather eat that first.
Mick, are you there?
Oh, yeah, it's the same experience, exactly the same experience. I've never got over an aversion to tomatoes. And the same with olives, but pork pies, I just crave them. Interestingly, I'm an immigrant to this country, obviously. Whenever I ask immigrants what it is they miss most about their home country, it's almost always a food item, even if it's readily available here. it's something to do with the sort of the memory of the preparation of the food item. So thanks very much.
Thank you for your call, Mick. I'm curious to know, Nigel. Mick talks about being away from the home where the food exists, but you go back to a place in time, to food that doesn't really exist as the major part of even, you know, most people's diets. Now, what you ate as a child, you know, chop and mash for lunch, is not what most children would be getting. Was it taking you back in, you know, to an experience of that era as well, when you dug out those old foods?
Well, certainly, because one of the ways in which I was fed as a child was meat and two vegetables day after day. Yes, there were lots of puddings, there were lots of cakes, but the main bit of every day was meat, potatoes, greens. And it wasn't a meal unless it was. Now, strangely, 40 years on, I so rarely eat like that. I eat Italian food, I eat Chinese food, Indian food, Thai food. It's very rare that I eat like that. But no one that I know when I was 9, 10, 11 would have had pasta. I mean, I think we were the first people to eat spaghetti in my class. I mean, I actually felt quite sophisticated because I've eaten spaghetti.
So you didn't eat it the first time around. There was something wrong with the cheese, or so you thought.
Well, yes. I mean, we didn't ever eat what we call foreign food. And my father suddenly decided we were going to have spaghetti. And the grocer said to him, if you're going to have spaghetti bolognese, you have to have this stuff called Parmesan cheese. So it came in a little drum, ready ground, and I peeled the top off and I sprinkled it over this first ever bowl of spaghetti and bolognese sauce, the sauce out of a can. And I remember just digging in my fork, bringing the mince up to my nose, and I just got that smell of Parmesan cheese. And I said, Daddy, I'm sorry, but this smells like sick. And he said, I know it does, son. I think it's off. Don't eat it.
Not a very successful start. Your father eventually remarries a woman who I think you first meet as a cleaning lady in the house, Auntie Joan. Is she cleaning the house? Am I right with that?
Auntie Joan was our cleaner. And when Mum was really becoming quite ill, Auntie Joan moved in, she was in those days Mrs. Potter, moved in almost trying to replace my mother. I mean, I could see, even at 9 years old, I felt uncomfortable with the way she started cooking for my father and the way she started caring for me when he was around, when she started speaking to me very lovingly.
Well, in part because, and people heard that in the reading about the rice pudding, your mom wasn't great in the kitchen, but Mrs. Potter was particularly good in the kitchen, right?
Mum tried. It was one of those things that it wasn't really her thing, cooking. It was part of the deal of getting married and bringing up a family. She didn't do it, you know, out of joy or passion, but she did it for me, and she did it with love. Mrs. Potter came in and cooked like an angel. And I could see my father actually really looking forward to his meals. You know, she seduced him with her baking.
You write at one point, and I'm not sure if I'm going to actually go to that place. Maybe I should do that, about lemon meringue pie. That's page 147. We hadn't written it out and sort of marked it as something to have you read. But you say in here that it was one of the most glorious things. Joan's lemon meringue pie was one of the most glorious things I had ever put in my mouth. Warm, painfully sharp lemon filling, the most airy pastry imaginable. But the association with that fabulous food and this woman, there's a disconnect there, because you never do get on with your stepmother, Joan.
I never do. And the lemon pie was actually the worst of it all, because I wanted to make it so much. I wanted to make it for my dad.
You wanted to make the pie yourself. At this point, you were baking this.
I desperately wanted to make it. And she wouldn't give me the recipe. So I used to sneak into the kitchen. I'd walk through on some errand or pretending I was doing something, and I'd take a look, and slowly but surely, over the months, I counted how many eggshells there were. I would note how much butter and gradually built up this recipe in my head. She would not give me the recipe. She hated the idea that I would be able to make a lemon pie for my father.
Did you think then of the idea that food was being used as a weapon in the family?
I'd seen it used to seduce my father. I'd seen it as a hook to catch him. And even at, I suppose then I was 14, 15 years old, I could see it being used quite definitely. Really almost to destroy the relationship between my father and I, because I wanted to do cookery at school. It was very difficult for him to accept that his youngest boy wasn't going to be an engineer and go into the family trade. He wanted to cook. And she knew that he wasn't happy with this. And yes, food was used in so many different ways in that house.
You're what, 16, 17 years old when you cook, create this fabulous wedding cake for them on their wedding, and she's so dismissive of that, it's so sad.
Why did I do this cake? I spent weeks making this cake. I spent my pocket money on buying all the little cutters to make this beautiful icing cake. And I have to say, it was wonderful. I think my father was quite shocked when he saw it. And I remember I could just see his eyes welling up with tears when I showed it to him. And he was so thrilled. And she just looked at it and said, "Well, you made a good job of that, didn't you, son?" And threw a tea towel over it.
It did appear at the wedding, I hope.
It appeared at the wedding, yes, it did.
Much against her better judgment? or, I mean, this... she goes... You might not say this, but it seems at one point when she feeds him, as much as she does in the latter years of his life, that she's overfeeding him.
She was overfeeding him. I mean, there was a point when Dad had a little bit of a heart problem, and he was rushed off to hospital and had some tests. And I suddenly noticed the food becoming more and more in our life. The bigger meals, more cakes, more pastries. I watched her feeding him.
Nigel Slater is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Food, we always talk about as unlocking those favorite memories, but Nigel's memoir, Toast, tells us that the memories that food unlocks are sometimes ones that even surprise us. Why is it, do you suppose, something like the taste or the smell of something can be so evocative? We'd like to have you join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. I know how cruel it is to be talking about food with someone who describes it so eloquently so close to lunchtime, but you'll just have to bear with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nigel Slater is my guest, and we're talking about his new memoir, Toast, The Story of One Boy's Hunger. To Charleston, South Carolina for our next call, and Don's with us. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yes, I've noticed that foods and smells and certain visual memories that you can remember very well sort of take you back to the past. And I've seen where the way your brain's wired up, smell in particular, which is more involved in food actually than taste, has kind of a privileged access going right into your brain with very little much less processing, you know, so that may be why it brings back a flood of memories. But I find that I'm a little afraid to think too much about childhood, not because it was bad, but because it seems so much sweeter than later in life that you tend to get lost in it, and it sort of highlights how much harder and narrower life tends to get as you go along. It seemed like there were endless possibilities when you're a child and everything was fresh and new. And as you go on through adolescence, and particularly as you get older and into middle age.
Well, Nigel, you crossed this line. I mean, at some point, the food does take you back to a time where things are simpler. But you choose to sort of go one step further back into memory.
Yes, I mean, it would have been quite easy in a way to just write about the taste of food and how it was. It actually was on the plate, and would have been quite simple. But yes, there were happy memories, certainly, which are easy to write about. I mean, they're quite easy to write about. I didn't avoid... I knew it wasn't going to be a sort of sugary saccharine type memoir because slowly but surely the food was dredging up a lot of things I didn't actually... things I hadn't thought about. For instance, mince pies, which, you know, I bake every Christmas and they smell wonderful. But I'd never really quite got to grips with the fact that that was what I was making with my mother the night before she died. And we'd had this terrible, terrible row. And it did actually bring back quite a few things. So, I mean, I totally understand about how Don feels about this. A lot of sweet memories, lots of sweet memories. But, you know, there's, I don't know, right now, everything is just a mixture of what I had and I can bring it, good and bad, I can bring it all to the table right now and sort it out.
1-800-423-TALK to Tony, who's joining us now from Panama City Beach in Florida. Hi, Tony.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question, and it's a great segue from the previous point. I was going to ask if y'all have any memories of just a completely awful food that brings up the greatest memory. And I have an example of my grandmother who taught me how to cook. Every first Sunday of November, we would have Fruitcake Sunday. And we would make just the most completely awful fruitcakes, those with the candied fruit, and they're just awful. I hate them. But it's the warmest memory of my grandmother in my life. And I really, just nasty candied fruitcake drenched in brandy, but it's such a beautiful memory.
And so you smell the fruitcake now, Tony, and what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Is it the warmth of the memory of your grandmother or how much you hate the taste?
They're both together, and I love the dichotomy. I love that both of them are together, you know?
You know, Tony, your fruitcake is my turkey stew. My father used to make this every Boxing Day, and we dreaded it.
This is the day after Christmas, Boxing Day for some people.
The day after Christmas, he would strip the carcass of the meat, and he'd make this ghastly thing. But, you know, strangely, it actually meant quite a lot. I've got fond memories of that. Many sort of better memories than some of the more successful things we made. And I think it's partly because it was the one thing that he used to make in the year for us. It was the one time in the entire year that Dad actually cooked for us and said, here you are.
Did you eat it?
We had to eat it. I mean, I would, even at Christmas, I had to clean my plate. I wouldn't have been able to leave the table until every scrap had gone. So, yes, I did eat it.
Tony, did you have to eat the fruitcake?
He's a better man than I. I can never stomach the fruitcake. I had my grandmother make one of the fruitcakes without the fruit, so I guess it was just cake.
Thanks for your call, Tony. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
1-800-423-TALK. And where are we going next? To Lafayette, Louisiana. Ian's with us. Hi, Ian.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking of how the texture and even the shape of some things remind us of some of our loved ones. My great-grandmother, who was born in 1901, at the age of 80 years old, decided she was going to help raise us as kids, and she had five of us. And at 80 years old, she was helping my mother out. And she always had this jar of these orange slices, gum-type candy, you know, the gum drops with the sugar on the outside.
Yeah.
And nobody ate them except me. And now I find myself going to places, and when I see them, I often go over and I take a bite, and they're actually not all that tasty. They get stuck to your teeth and everything, but I think I do it just to remind myself of those happy times that I had with my great-grandmother and how they were so special to me.
You know, it's so funny, Ian, that you mentioned those slices because I was the only one in the family that liked them too. And what I liked about them was the way the sugar actually almost hurt your teeth because they were quite chewy and then inside sort of a little bit soft. No one would touch them. We had them every Christmas and they were passed around. And I knew that everyone was going to say, no, thank you. We don't want any. Even though we had them every Christmas without fail, I knew I was going to end up with them. And I absolutely loved that grating on your teeth of those little sugar things. But no, they're not actually nice. Orange and lemon slices. They're actually not that nice.
I totally agree. Thanks. And I'm enjoying the conversation thoroughly.
We used to get this package every Christmas from a woman in Edinburgh, and my father thought it was desperately special, in part because it came from across the ocean. and in part because it came from the woman who where he had been a boarder as a student studying in Edinburgh when he was much younger. It was Edinburgh rock candy. I don't know if you know that. It comes as sort of pillars of powdered sugar clamped together.
Yeah.
He was really excited about it, and we all got really excited about it, and then it got passed around, and it really wasn't that exciting to eat. But every Christmas, it would come around again. It's like, it's my time to open the Edinburgh rock candy. So it's the same kind of thing. Those notions that take you back to points in your life that you remember, and it doesn't necessarily have to be something that tasted fantastic. I don't know if you know the candy I'm describing.
Well, I know it well. I mean, it's kept dentists in business for years. You can feel your fillings just popping out when you have that stuff. But I'm the only person I've ever come across who used to keep it deliberately for weeks so that it would actually go slightly soft, because I loved soft candy. Everyone thinks I'm mad, but I always used to do that.
Yeah, I thought about it. It just sort of came to my mind when you talked about the sugar that made your teeth hurt, because this one sort of gets so packed into the molars. Where are we off to next? Buffalo, New York. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks for talking to me, and I have a great memory. It's not food specifically, but a medicine my beautiful southern South Carolinian mother would give my sister and me every day, and we got a nickname, called it Mortimaro. And what it was either castor oil or cod liver oil. And now somehow with her magic, being wonderful, angelic kind of mother that she was.
Did it come on a spoon or was it in little pills? Did it come from a bottle in a spoon?
It was liquid, like a spoonful.
All right.
And it became more tomorrow, and it was, I almost think we were looking forward to it, and it was awful, I'm sure, right? But somehow she waved her magic wand, and it became a ritual that we certainly at least tolerated, and I think somewhat a little bit more for some reason, the way she was able to wave, just make it something that was more than palatable. I never could figure that one out.
Perhaps because it's delivered with affection. Maybe that's it's the gesture that goes along with it. I don't know, Nigel. But
it's something that is done to make you feel better, and you know that somebody cares enough to do that. It's like we used to have these little bitter orange-flavored pills, which I used to be made to take every time we went on a car journey. And I absolutely hated them, but it was like somebody really, really cared enough about me and my welfare to give me these pills. And in a strange way, I too looked forward to them. Very odd, but I mean, the castor oil thing, oh, Jeff, please, horrible.
There's another part from your book that I'd like to have you read for us, and it takes us... Jeff reminds me of this kind of connection of an experience that it's a little bit bittersweet that comes in part with food. I wonder if you need to set this up for us, Nigel. This is the story about the crumble.
Yes, crumble was one of the desserts that my mother would always make for me. One of the very few things that she did that was... I mean, she tried. It wasn't the perfect crumble, I have to say, because the crust topping was always a bit too chewy and a bit dry, and the apples were very, very watery. And she used to make this, but I still looked forward to it. This was an autumn and winter pudding that we made. Apple crumble. There are shouts from the boys up the road firing snowballs at one another. I'm playing alone, about 100 yards from them. My mother is watching me through the dining room window. She looks worried. I am the proprietor of an imaginary cheese shop, carving slices of cheddar from the huge rock of snow lit by the street lamp. As I ask my customer what they want, I catch my mother's eye. I smile and wave at her, but she looks down, embarrassed. The front door opens and she calls to me. It's time to come in now. Why can't I just stay out a bit longer? There's a queue. You must be freezing. You've been out there for hours, and anyway, it'll be dark soon. I ask, were you watching for Daddy? No, I was watching you. What game are you playing? I'm playing grocers. I've been selling cheese like Percy Salt the grocer does in his shop. She comes out and looks anxiously up the road at the boys having fun, yelling and running and sliding in the snow. Five of them, four of them from my own class. She looks disappointed. A cold little smile. She puts her arm around me, wincing at the frozen hairs on my cold duffel coat. Come on in. I've made a crumble.
Such a sad story. Because I think anyone who's been a parent will know those moments of looking out and seeing someone who's a little bit lonely and maybe should be playing with the other kids. But again, it sort of brings us back to where we were at the beginning of the program. And I'm not sure if in this story, Nigel, food is unlocking the memory of the moment or food isn't the moment itself, because the crumble's so essential to this recollection. It's not just necessarily, it doesn't seem that it brought you back, but it's so much a part of it.
There were several things in the book that somehow it was the absolute essence of that memory. The trifle that we would have every Christmas with sponge cake and cream and fruit. It was absolutely Christmas, just one sniff of it, and it took me there. And writing about any Christmas, I have to write about that trifle, because it almost was like a great sort of blanket over the entire festival. It was the most important thing, was that.
Now, I'm told, or I read somewhere, that there's talk of making a film of Toast already. Is that right?
There has been talk of making a film.
What do you think about that?
Well, I'm intrigued. I think it could be huge fun, partly because the 1940s and 50s have actually been covered on film,
right,
quite a lot. And obviously there's a lot of recent films. But there's a stretch of English history in the 1960s and 70s which really hasn't been covered, and that's of the home life. And in fact, how...
Yeah, because the hippie thing was going on, the Piccadilly Street and all that, that was well covered, but that was really only a very tiny little part of the country at that point.
Oh, I would so long to have been a hippie. My father would have been horrified. Absolutely. I did manage to get a little bell to wear my neck, you know, around my neck out of him, but he was horrified at that. But yes, it's a little slice of English life.
Well, and you do very well in evoking not only that, but telling us the story and teaching us a little bit about the way that we think about the food in our memory. I thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Nigel Slater, his memoir is called Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Kevin Sullivan. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.